Remember that I come from Ix, so I appreciate the marvels of technology, Rumber said. Now I'm a living example of it. If any person is better suited to adapt to this new situation, I'd like to meet him. For years, the exiled Prince Rumber had been biding his time, sending minimal support to the resistance movement on his devastated homeworld, including explosive wafers and military supplies provided by Duke Leto. In recent months, as Rumber grew stronger physically, he also grew stronger mentally. Though he was only a fraction of a man, every day he spoke of the need to recapture Ix, to the point where Duke Leto and even his concubine Tessia sometimes had to tell him to calm down. Finally, Leto had agreed to risk sending the reconnaissance team of Gurney and Thufir, clutching at a goal of his own, a new determination to accomplish something good in the face of all the tragedies he had survived. It was not a matter of if they could mount an attack, it was a matter of when and how. Tessia spoke without shifting her gaze.
Don't underestimate Romber's strength. You of all people know how one must adapt in order to survive.
Jessica couldn't help but notice the adoring look on the concubine's face. Tessia and Rumber had spent years together on Caladan, during which time she had encouraged him to support the freedom fighters on Ix, so that he might regain his royal position. Tessia had stood by him through the worst times, even after the explosion. Upon returning to consciousness, Rumber had said,
"I am surprised you stayed."
"As long as you need me, I will remain."
Tessia was a whirlwind working on his behalf, supervising the modification of his castle apartments and preparing devices to assist him. Much of Tessia's time was devoted to making him stronger.
"Once Prince Rumber is feeling better," she had announced, "he will lead the Ixian people to victory."
Jessica didn't know if the brown-haired woman followed her heart or fulfilled an unknown set of instructions secretly given to her by the sisterhood. All through her own childhood, Jessica had listened to her teacher and mentor, Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam. She had followed her every draconian instruction, learning what the old woman had to teach her. But now the sisterhood wanted the Duke's genetics combined with hers. In no uncertain terms, Jessica had been ordered to seduce Leto and conceive an Atreides' daughter. When she experienced unfamiliar and forbidden feelings of love for this dark and moody Duke, however, Jessica had developed a rebellious streak and delayed becoming pregnant. Then, in the wake of Victor's death and Leto's destructive depression, she had allowed herself to conceive a son, against the strictest of orders. Mohiam would feel betrayed and deeply disappointed. But Jessica could always bear a daughter later, couldn't she? In his reinforced chair, Rumber bent his left arm and cautiously thrust his stiff fingertips into a pocket of the short robe. He aimed carefully with his fingers, fished about in there. Finally, he grasped a piece of paper, which he painstakingly unfolded.
"Look at the fine motor control," Yue said. "This is better than I had expected. You've been practicing, Rumber?"
"Every second." The prince held up the paper. "I keep remembering new things each day. This is the best sketch I've been able to make of a few obscure access tunnels on Ix. Gurney and Thufir will find them useful."
"The other paths have proven too dangerous," the Mentat said. Over the decades, spies had tried to break through the Tlaloxu defenses. Several Atreides infiltrators had slipped in, but never returned. Others had been unable to enter the underground world at all. But Rumber, the son of Earl Dominic Vernius, had dredged his memory for information about secret security systems and hidden entrances to the cavern cities. During his long and enforced convalescence, he had begun to recall obscure details he had believed long forgotten, details that might make the difference in penetrating the enemy stronghold.
Turning his attention to his meal, Romber lifted a large piece of parafish on his fork. Then, noting Dr. Yue's disapproving gaze, he lowered the morsel to his plate and cut off a smaller portion instead. Leto stared at his murky reflection in the hall's polished blue obsidian wall. Like wolves ready to prey upon any member who shows weakness, some noble families are just waiting for me to falter. The Harkonnens, for example. Since the Skyclipper disaster, a hardened Duke Leto had grown unwilling to accept injustice in silence. He needed to make a difference on Ix as much as Romber did. We must let all the Imperium see that House Atreides is as strong as ever. When we try to conceal our innermost drives, our entire being screams betrayal. Bene Gesserit teaching. It pained Lady Anirule to see the truth-sayer Lobia dying on a woven mat in her austere apartment. Ah, my friend, you deserve so much more than this. The ancient sister had weakened in recent years, but clung tenaciously to life. Rather than returning to the familiar halls of the mother school on Wallach 9, as was her right, Lobia insisted upon continuing her duties for the Golden Lion throne. Her marvelous mind, what she called her most precious possession, remained sharp. As the imperial truth-sayer, Lobia faithfully ferreted out lies and deceit spoken in the presence of Shaddam the Fourth, though the Emperor rarely showed any appreciation of her. Now the fading woman looked up at Anirule, who stood haloed by the gentle light of glow-globes, her shadowed face concealing tears. This old sister was her closest confidant in the immense palace, not merely a fellow Bene Gesserit, but also a spry and fascinating person with whom she could share her thoughts and secrets. Now she was dying. "You will be fine, Mother Lobia," Anirule said. The plastone walls of the sparse, unheated room retained a chill that penetrated to the bone. "I think you are getting stronger." The old woman's answer was like crackling dry leaves. "Never lie to a truth-sayer, especially not the Emperor's truth-sayer." It was an oft-repeated admonition. Lobia's roomy eyes danced with self-deprecating mirth, even as her chest labored to maintain the rhythm of breathing. "Have you learned nothing from me?" "I have learned that you are stubborn, my friend. You should allow me to call for the medical sisters. Yosa can tend to your illness." "The sisterhood doesn't need me alive any longer, child. No matter how much you might wish it. Do I need to chide you for having feelings, or should I save us both the embarrassment?" Lobia coughed, then went through the calming regimen of Bindu suspension, taking two deep breaths and completing the ritual. Her respiration became smooth, as if she were a young woman again, without the concerns of mortality. "We were not meant to live forever. Though, with the voices in other memory, it might seem so. I think you just enjoy challenging my preconceptions, Mother Lobia." They often swam together in the palace's underground canals. They played intense strategy games, staring at each other for hours, winning through minute nuances. Anirule did not want to let go. Though the ancient truth-sayer lived in the lavish imperial palace, there were no adornments on the walls of her quarters, no carpets on the hardwood floors. Lobia had removed the original opulent paintings, plush imported rugs, and prismatic film window coverings. "Such creature comforts clutter the mind," she had told Anirule. "Personal objects are a waste of time and energy." "And does the human mind not create these luxuries?" Anirule countered. "Superior human minds create marvelous things, but Thick-headed people lust after them for their own sake. I prefer not to be thick-headed. How I will miss these discussions when she is gone.
With monumental sadness, Anirul wondered if the Emperor had even noticed the old woman's absence. For decades, Lobbia had been the finest of truth-sayers, able to note the tiniest sheen of perspiration on the skin, the tilt of a head, a curl of the lips, a tone of voice, and much more. Without stirring on the hard mat, Lobbia abruptly opened her eyes.
It is time.
Dread inflamed Anirul's heart like a hot coal.
I shall not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration.
She whispered.
I understand, Mother Lobbia. I am ready to help you. I will face my fear. I will allow it to pass over me and through me.
Fighting tears, forcing herself to maintain her Bene Gesserit composure, Anirul leaned forward and touched her forehead to the dry-skinned temple of the aged truth-sayer, as if bending over a prayer mat. One important task remained before Lobbia allowed herself to pass on. Anirul did not want to lose the old woman's conversation and friendship in this lonely palace, but she need not relinquish the revered truth-sayer's companionship. Not entirely.
Share with me, Lobbia. I have room inside for all your memories.
Deep in her consciousness, Anirul felt the excitement and clamor of the multitude there. Other memory. The genetically recorded experiences of all her ancestors. As the Kwisatz mother, Anirul's mind was particularly receptive to ancient thoughts and lives, dating back across the generations. Soon, Lobbia would join them all. Against her forehead, she felt the old woman's ebbing pulse. The heartbeat steadied, their minds opened, and the flow began, like a torrent through an open dam. Lobbia poured her life into Anirul, transferring memories, aspects of personality, every bit of data contained in her long life. One day, Anirul herself would pass the information to another, younger sister. In this manner, the sisterhood's collective memory was amassed and made potentially available to all Bene Gesserit. Empty of life, Lobbia sagged into an empty husk, like a long-held sigh. Now the record book of the old woman lived within Anirul, among all the other voices. When the time was right, the Kwisatz mother could call forth the memories of Lobbia within, and they would spend time together again. Hearing a soft voice, Anirul glanced to one side and immediately masked her emotions. She dared not let any other sister see such weakness, even at a moment of great grief. At the doorway stood a pretty young acolyte, motioning for her.
An important visitor, my lady. Please follow me.
Anirul was surprised at how calmly the words came out of her mouth.
Sister Lobbia is dead. We must inform Mother Superior that the Emperor will need a new truth-sayer.
With a brief, longing look at the ancient woman lying cold and empty on the hard mat, Anirul departed with the merest whisper of footsteps. The pretty acolyte looked at her in astonishment, then accepted the news. She led Anirul to an elegant private parlor, where Reverend Mother Mohiam waited. A hollow-cheeked woman with graying hair, Mohiam wore a black abba robe, the traditional conservative dress of the sisterhood. Before Mohiam could speak, Anirul crisply and emotionlessly told her about the death of Lobbia. The other reverend mother did not seem surprised.
I too bring long-anticipated news, Lady Anirul. You will find it especially heartening on this day of passing.
She spoke in an ancient, forgotten language that no eavesdropper could interpret. At last, Jessica carries the child of Duke Leto Atreides, as she has been instructed to do.
Anirul's expression lost its air of gloom, and she seized upon the bright prospect of new life. After millennia of meticulous planning, the most important Bene Gesserit plans would soon come to fruition. The daughter, now in Jessica's womb, would become the mother of their long-awaited prize, the Kwisatz Haderach, a messiah under the control of the sisterhood.
Perhaps this is not such a dark day after all.
If every living human had the power of prescience, it would be meaningless, for where could it then be applied? Norma Senva, The Calculus of Philosophy, Ancient Guild Records, Private Rusek Collection. Human habitation of the planet Junction dated back before the founding of the Spacing Guild by the legendary patriot and commercial magnate Aurelius Venport. Centuries after the Butlerian Jihad, when the still-fledgling guild had sought a homeworld that could accommodate their massive highliners, the sweeping plains and sparse population of Junction fit the requirements perfectly. Now the world was covered with guild landing fields, repair facilities, immense maintenance yards, and high-security schools for the mysterious navigators. No longer entirely human, Steersman Demur swam inside a sealed tank of spice gas and gazed out upon Junction with the eyes of his mind. The pungent, cinnamon odor of pure melange permeated his skin, his lungs, his mind. Nothing could possibly smell sweeter. His armored chamber was carried in the mechanical grasp of a podplane that soared silently above the skyline toward the new highliner to which he had been assigned. Demur lived for making fold space journeys across star systems in the blink of an eye. And that was only the smallest part of what he understood, now that he had evolved so far beyond his original form. The bulbous podplane crossed a broad field of grounded highliners, kilometers and kilometers of monstrous ships, responsible for the commerce of the Imperium. Pride was a primitive human emotion, but Demur could still take pleasure in knowing his place in the universe. He gazed at the main yard and maintenance locks, where the vessels were serviced and upgraded with modular fittings. The hull of one immense craft was pitted from severe asteroid damage. An old navigator had been severely injured aboard it. Demur felt a flicker of sadness, another lingering shadow of the Ixian boy he had once been. One day, if he focused his expanded mind, even that remnant of his former self would be vanquished. Ahead lay the neat white markers of Navigator's Field, which memorialized fallen navigators. A pair of markers were bright and new, installed only recently, after the deaths of two pilots who had been experimental subjects. The volunteers had been altered for a dangerous, instantaneous communications project called GuildLink, based on Demur's own long-distance connection with his twin brother, Kater. That project had failed, though. After only a few successful uses, the mentally coupled navigators had collapsed into brain-dead torpidity. The guild had scrapped further GuildLink research, despite the enormous potential profits. Navigators were too talented and too expensive to risk in such a way. With a whir of jets and rushing air, the podplane set down at the perimeter of the memorial field, near the base of the Oracle of Infinity. The large clear-plas globe contained swirls and streaks of gold, an ever-changing nebula of stars moving and shifting. The activity increased as a uniformed guildsman guided Demur's tank out of the transport craft.
Prior to each tour of duty, it was customary for a navigator to commune at the Oracle, to enhance and refine his prescient abilities. The experience, similar to the very act of traveling through the glories of Fold space, connected him with the mysterious origins of the Guild. Closing his small eyes, Demur felt the Oracle of Infinity fill his senses, wave after incoming wave opening his mind, until all possibilities were apparent to him. He felt another presence watching over him, like the sentient mind of the Guild itself, and it gave him a sense of peace. Guided by the ancient and powerful Oracle, Demur's mind experienced the past and future of time and space, all that was beautiful in creation, all that was perfect. The spice gas in his tank seemed to stretch until it encompassed the mutated faces of thousands of navigators. Images danced and shifted, from navigator to human, back and forth. He saw a woman, her body changing and atrophying, until she became little more than a naked, enormous brain. Inside the Oracle, the images faded, leaving him with an ominous, empty feeling. His eyes still closed, he saw only the swirling nebula within the Clearplaz globe. As the claws of the podcraft grasped his tank and raised him again, flying toward the waiting highliner, Demur was left in an unsettled quandary. He saw many things through Fold space, but not all. Not nearly enough. Powerful, unpredictable forces were at work across the cosmos. Forces that even the Oracle of Infinity could not see. Mere humans, not even powerful leaders like Shaddam the Fourth, could not understand what they might unleash. And the universe was a dangerous place. Melange is a many-handed monster. The spice gives with one hand and takes with all of its others. Confidential Choam Memorandum. For the Emperor's eyes only. Within a complex of linked underground laboratory buildings, the white capsule car sped along a tramway. Rattling over aging tracks, the car stuttered for an unsettling moment before continuing. Through the Clearplaz floor of the car, Master Researcher Hidar Fenajidika could see overpasses, conveyors, and technical systems functioning together for a vital mission. All of it under my supervision. Though the Emperor deluded himself that he directed all progress made here on Xuta, once called Ix, no man was as vital as Ajitika. Eventually, all the politicians and nobles, even the short-sighted representatives of his own Tleilaxu race, would begin to understand. By then it would be too late to prevent the Master Researcher's inevitable victory. His capsule car clattered toward the heavily guarded research pavilion. Before his people had conquered this planet, the advanced Ixian manufacturing facilities had produced vast wealth for House Vernius. Now the laboratories and manufactories were put to even better use for the glory of God and the mastery of the chosen Tleilaxu race. Today, though, he had different trials to face. Ajitika was not looking forward to another meeting with Count Fenring, the Imperial Spice Minister. But at last he had good news to report, enough to keep the Emperor's Sardaukar troops at bay. In recent months, he had supervised a plethora of full-scale testing operations on the artificial spice. Parallel analyses to compare the effects of melange and amal in the most minute detail. One difficult veil of secrecy, the ritualistic uses of melange by the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, had been broken by a fortuitous occurrence when one of the witch's spies had fallen unexpectedly into his lap. Now that captive woman, who had passed herself off under the name of Miral Alekhem, served a higher purpose. The whirring capsule car came to a lurching stop at the pavilion, and Ajitika stepped out onto a spotless white platform. Fenring would already be there, and the man did not like to be kept waiting. Ajitika hurried into a lift tube, which dropped him to the main level of the pavilion. But the round door did not dilate open. Annoyed, he pressed an emergency alarm and shouted into the comm speaker, "Get me out of here and hurry up about it. I am a busy man." This lift tube was based upon an Ixion design. But now a simple door wouldn't open. What could be more basic? Too many things were beginning to fall apart in these supposedly wondrous research facilities. Could it be sabotage by those persistent, faceless rebels? Or simply poor maintenance? He heard men chattering outside and tools hammering against the jammed door. Ajitika disliked enclosed spaces, hated to live underground. Now the redolent air seemed to thicken around him. He whispered the catechism of the great belief and humbly asked God for a safe passage. Grabbing a vial from his pocket, he removed two foul-tasting lozenges and swallowed them. Why is it taking them so long? Struggling to calm himself, Ajitika reviewed a plan he had set in motion. Since the beginning of this project decades ago, he had been in contact with a small cadre of Tlaloxu who would serve him after he escaped with the sacred axolotl tanks. In the farthest reaches of the Imperium, protected by deadly face dancers, he would set up his own Tlaloxu regime for the true interpretation of the great belief. Arrangements had already been made to conceal him, his face dancer entourage, and the secret of a Mal in a long-range frigate. After his escape, he would detonate a bomb that would destroy this entire laboratory complex. The massive explosion would take half of the surrounding underground city with it. Before the dust settled, he would be far, far away. From his safe planet, Ajitika would take steps to solidify his power base and assemble a military force to protect himself from Imperial reprisals. He alone would control the vital and inexpensive supply of synthetic melange. He who controls the spice controls the universe. Ultimately, Ajitika might sit upon the Golden Lion throne itself. If only he could get out of this malfunctioning lift. Finally, with a great clatter and loud shouts, the lift tube door squealed open, and two assistants peered in at him. "Are you well, Master?" Behind them, wearing a bemused expression, stood Count Fenring. While not a tall man, he still towered over the Tlaloxu. "A bit of trouble, Straightening himself, Ajitika pushed out of the cramped tube, shouldering his sputtering subordinates out of the way. "Come with me, Count Fenring." The master researcher led the spice minister to a familiar demonstration room, an enormous chamber with white smooth plaz walls, floors, and ceiling. The room contained scientific instruments and receptacles, and a red table topped by a translucent dome. "You're going to show me one of the desert worms again? Another small one, I hope, and not as sickly as the last." Ajitika brought forth a plas vial containing an orangish ooze, which he held under Fenring's nostrils. "Latest batch of Amal. Smells like melange, don't you agree?" Fenring's nose twitched as he inhaled. Without waiting for an answer, Ajitika pressed a button at the base of the dome. The foggy plas cleared, revealing churned sand that half covered a meter-long sandworm. "How long from Arrakis?" Fenring asked. "We smuggled this one in 11 days ago. Worms always die away from their home, but it should live another month, maybe two." Ajitika poured the orange liquid into a receptacle at the top of the dome. The receptacle dropped, embedded itself in the sand, and tilted toward the worm. The snake-sized creature slithered toward the Amal, its round mouth open to reveal tiny crystal teeth deep inside its throat. In a sudden, violent motion, the creature lunged at the orange substance and devoured it, receptacle and all. Meeting Fenring's inquisitive gaze, Ajitika said, "Just like real melange?"
"The worms still die, though." The spice minister clung to his skepticism.
"They die whether we give them a mal or melange. It makes no difference. They simply cannot live away from their native desert."
"I see. I'd like to take a sample to the Emperor now. Have it prepared."
In a condescending tone, Ajitika answered, "A mal is a biological substance and is dangerous if not handled properly. The final product will be safe only after the addition of a stabilizing agent."
"Well, add it then,
I'll wait here while you do it." The master researcher shook his head. "We are in the process of testing a number of such agents now. Melange is an extremely complex substance, but success is imminent. Come back when I summon you."
"You do not summon me. I report only to the Emperor."
Looking through heavily lidded eyes, Ajitika responded in an arrogant tone, "Then report to him what I have told you. No person can tell the difference between a mal and genuine melange." Observing Fenring's frustrated reaction, he smiled to himself. The stabilizing agent was a sham. Neither the Emperor nor Ajitika's incompetent Tlaloxu superiors would ever receive true Amal. Instead, the master researcher would escape and take everything with him, leaving no clues about the actual extremely potent spice substitute, which he called Ajitamal. If the formulation could fool a sandworm of Arrakis, what more convincing test could there possibly be? Fenring said, "Always remember that I convinced Elrood to begin this project in the first place, Therefore I feel a tremendous sense of responsibility." He paced the small room. "You have performed spacing guild tests, I presume? We must know if a navigator can use your synthetic melange to envision safe paths through fold space." Ajitika struggled for a reply. He hadn't expected such a question.
"Apparently not.
Did I strike a nerve? Rest assured, a navigator will notice no difference either." Ajitika touched the button to fog over the dome containing the worm. Fenring pressed his advantage. "Nevertheless, the supreme test would be to place a mal inside a navigator's tank. Only then can we be sure."
"But we cannot accomplish that, sir." Ajitika squirmed.
"We cannot openly request guild cooperation, since Project Amal must remain completely secret." The Count's eyes glittered as schemes blossomed in his mind.
"But one of your face dancers might breach even the guild's tight security."
"Yes, I will accompany your face dancer to see that it's done properly." Ajitika considered the suggestion. This imperial functionary did have a point. Moreover, using a face dancer presented him with other possibilities. A way of getting rid of this meddlesome man. Unknown to anyone except Ajitika himself, he had already disseminated hundreds of the tank-bred face dancers to strategic locations around the galaxy, transporting them in long-range exploration vessels to uncharted reaches. The shapeshifters had been developed centuries ago, but their possibilities had not been adequately explored. That was about to change.
"Yes, Count Fenring, I can arrange for a face dancer to accompany you."
With so many distractions, Ajitika felt he would never finish his work. An overeager group of politicians arrived from the sacred city of Bandalong on the Bene Tlaloc's homeworlds. Their leader, Master Zaf, was a haughty man with rodent eyes and a perpetual upward curl of his tiny mouth. Ajitika couldn't decide whom he loathed more, Fenring or the inept Tlaloxu representatives. Given the scientific abilities of the Bene Tlaloc's, he couldn't understand how Master Zaf and other government leaders had bungled political affairs so badly. Forgetting the majesty of their place in the universe, They were content to be ground underfoot by Powenda noble families.
"What did you say to the Imperial Spice Minister?" Zaf demanded, as he strutted into Ajitika's large office. "I must have a full report."
Ajitika drummed his fingers on the Frostplaz desktop. He grew tired of explaining himself to outsiders. They always asked such inane questions. "One day I will no longer have to deal with idiots." After Ajitika had summarized the meeting, Zaf announced in a pompous tone, "Now we wish to observe your Amal tests ourselves. We have the right." Though Zaf was his superior, Ajitika feared nothing from the man, since no one could replace him on this project. "There are thousands of ongoing experiments. You wish to see all of them? How long is your lifespan, Master Zaf?"
"Show us the most significant. Don't you agree, gentlemen?"
Zaf glanced at his companions. They nodded and grunted.
"Watch this test, then."
With a confident smile, Ajitika took the vial of liquid Ajitamal from his pocket and poured the rest of the contents into his own mouth. He tasted the substance on his tongue, inhaled the cinnamon essence into his sinuses, and swallowed. This was the first time he'd actually consumed so much at once. Within seconds, a pleasantly warm feeling permeated his stomach and brain, matching any experience he'd ever enjoyed with genuine melange. He chuckled at the shocked expressions on his visitors' faces. "I've been doing this for weeks," he lied, "and there have been no ill effects." He was convinced God would not permit anything bad to happen to him. "There can be no doubt whatsoever." The Tlaloxu politicians chattered excitedly, congratulating each other as if they'd had a hand in this success. Zaf flashed small teeth and bent forward with a conspiratorial expression.
"Excellent, Master Researcher. We shall see that you are properly rewarded. But first, we have an important matter to discuss."
Suffused in the warmth of Ajitimal, Ajitika listened to Zaf. The Bene Tlaloc were still stinging from Duke Leto's rebuff of their calculated offer to make a gola of his dead son Victor. Burning to avenge what they still believed to be an Atreides attack decades before, and angry at the continuing Ixian resistance here on Xuta that used Prince Romber Vernius as a figurehead, Zaf wanted to seize Vernius and Atreides' genetic lines for Bene Tlaloc's schemes. DNA? They might tailor special diseases that could potentially wipe out House Atreides and House Vernius. If the Tlaloxu felt particularly vengeful, they could even clone simulacrums of Leto and Romber and publicly torture them to death, over and over again if they wished. How much could the Atreides stand? Even fragmented genetic material from those bloodlines would be sufficient to perform many experiments. But the Duke's refusal had crushed those plans. To Ajitika's hyper-focused mind, Zaf's words were distant and irrelevant. But he listened without comment, allowing Zaf to plod through his plans to thwart House Atreides and House Vernius. He described a war memorial in the jungles of Beakal, where almost a millennium ago, Atreides and Vernius troops had fought side by side in a legendary last stand known as the Senesar Defense. Several of their heroic ancestors had been entombed there in a jungle shrine. Ajitika fought off boredom as Zaf continued. "We have arranged with the Beakali government to exhume and take cellular samples from any bodies we find there. Not an ideal situation, but it should provide enough genetic fragments for our purposes."
"And Leto Atreides can do nothing to prevent it," chimed in one of his companions.
"Thus we will get what we want, the perfect revenge." The Tlaloxu never considered all the possibilities, though. Ajitika tried to keep the disgust from his expression. "The Duke will be furious when he discovers your intent. Do you not fear Atreides' reprisals?"
"Leto is crippled with grief and has completely neglected his Landsrad duties.
Master Zaf looked far too smug. We need fear nothing from him. Our retrieval operations are already underway, but we have encountered a small snag. The Prime Magistrate of Beakal has demanded a huge payment from us. I was hoping we could pay him with Amal and allow him to think it is melange. Is your substitute good enough to fool them? Angelica laughed, already envisioning new possibilities. Absolutely. But he would use an early formula, similar enough to dupe them without wasting the precious Ajinimal. The Beakali used melange only in food and drink anyway, so they wouldn't notice the difference. It would be a simple matter. I can produce as much as you require. There are tides of leadership, rising and falling. Into each emperor's reign flow the tides, ebbing and surging. Prince Raphael Corino. Discourses on Leadership in a Galactic Imperium, 12th edition. Beneath the tasseled awning of an observation stand, Shaddam IV sat in pleasantly perfumed shade, watching the clockwork maneuvers of his troops. Of all the marvels on Kaitain, these Sardaukar were the most magnificent, as far as he was concerned. Could there be a more heartwarming sight than spotlessly uniformed men following his every order with cool precision? How he wished all of his subjects responded to imperial instructions as willingly. A thin, elegant man with an aquiline nose, Shaddam wore a gray Sardaukar uniform, trimmed with silver and gold. He was their commander-in-chief, in addition to his other duties. Over his reddish hair, he had settled a padded Berserk's helmet that bore the imperial crest in gold. At least he could watch the crisp parade in peace, since his wife Anirul had long ago grown tired of military exhibitions. Thankfully, she had chosen to tend to Bene Gesserit matters for the afternoon, doting on her daughters and raising them to be witches themselves, or maybe dealing with funeral arrangements for the dead old crone Lobia. He hoped the Bene Gesserit would provide him with a new truth-sayer soon. What else were the damnable sisters good for? On the open plaza below, the Sardaukar Corps paraded in flawless unison, boots echoing like gunfire across the swept flagstones. Supreme Bashar Zum Garon, a loyal old veteran from Seleucus Secundus, guided his soldiers like a skilled puppeteer, performing spectacular maneuvers that demonstrated efficient battle formations. Perfect. Unlike the Emperor's own family. Normally, the Emperor loved to watch his troops practice, but at the moment his stomach was agitated.